And now we have the pleasure of hearing from Emma Kubi, who will pull these rich papers together and open up discussion. So Emma Kubi will be, and we're very happy to announce, Associate Professor of History as of August 1st. It's just around the corner at Northern Illinois University. Her book, Political Survivors, The Resistance, the Cold War, and the Fight Against Concentration Camps after 1945 was published last month by Cornell and is here, I'm sure, in the book fair. It tells the story of an international activist group of Nazi camp survivors and their crusade against post-war political detention systems from the USSR to French Algeria. She's also the article of several authors, on violence, empire, and memory in 20th century France. So thank you, Emma. And then after Emma's given her comments, I'm going to invite the panel to come up front so we can open up to questions.
Okay, we have about half an hour left.
Yes.
I just want to thank the panelists for, I think, a great panel, full of surprising resonances and connections. And speaking of resonances and connections, I want to echo Alice in urging everyone to check out the H. France Salon on Race and Racism, edited by Emily and by Christine Pikikara, who's in the row, two rows back from Emily, that just extends this conversation in kind of all sorts of interesting ways. This is a panel I know the audience will want to engage with. I will try to be relatively brief, but I do have some things I'd like to say to these papers. So what I thought I would do is just frame discussion by drawing out a couple of potential strands of connection among the three papers, one of which has to do with temporality, with thinking about race in the post or after of something else, and then the other to do with thinking about race as intellectual history within complex or uneven transnational geographies that involve both Africa and Europe, with Europe kind of explicitly construed as something beyond metropolitan France itself. Mariam refers early in her paper to, quote, what I am awkwardly naming post-racial capitalism. In the written version, you had tentatively there instead of awkwardly. And by this, she evidently does not mean a capitalism that is actually after race, right? But rather, as I read it, in the tradition of post-colonial theory, a capitalism that falsely avows itself to have moved past or beyond race while remaining hopelessly tangled up in racial categories and indeed engaging in a project of reconstituting them in new vocabularies. Emily and Julia's papers are likewise situated in this post-racial temporality, in their case explicitly in the aftermath of World War II, in which Nazi framings of race were being loudly disavowed and discarded, and during which expectations were briefly raised for various forms of racial justice or even equity. As Emily shows us in heartbreaking fashion, this was a liminal moment in which some of her actors possessed, quote, hopes for a post-war world in which racism would be eliminated. Julia's actors, operating in an even more complex aftermath of two world wars and two French occupations, possessed no such magnificent dreams. But they did appear to imagine that the elimination of Hitler's Reich at least raised the possibility of some form of historical recognition and juridical justice for earlier acts of anti-black racism and violence. And as she underlines, in the interregnum of the immediate post-war moment, which I take to be essentially until the 1950s, this belief had some basis in reality. She writes, quote, despite strong continuities in anti-black racism across 1945 and despite, quote, the resilience of racism, denazification efforts did open up a political space, in Julia's words again, for victims' voices to register eugenicist sterilization as a crime. I think Julia's language here of simultaneous continuities and new openings is actually crucial to all three papers in terms of the ways that they invite us and challenge us to think about aftermaths. all three papers rightly reject the notion that nothing really changed in the post-war period, right? That the history of European racism is just one damn thing over and over again. Emily is particularly insistent and particularly convincing that the racial common sense she's tracing in her larger project is, again, these are her words, a fundamentally new, specifically post-war ideological formation, that this is not old wine in new bottles. Mariam likewise insists that the Fifth Republic marks what she calls a break with earlier traditions of economic planning. But what I think is exciting about all three of these papers, and this is evidently a continuation of the conversation that Sandrine Sanos opened up for a number of us yesterday in her comment on a different panel, is that, to my mind, all three papers demonstrate the ways in which the ongoing, what Sandrine called the presence of the past and the need to work over and around its haunting legacies is precisely what creates the break between present and past. What sets the present apart from what came before, right, is the need to account for and work in the kind of disrupting presence of knowledge of what has happened. And so, in other words, this isn't a narrative of radical disjuncture in any of these three cases. It's rather, it's quite distinctly a narrative of just how vital various forms of historical disavowal, denial, forgetting, and erasure, and in all three cases, erasure of histories of violence, were in allowing actors in the post to forge new forms of racial common sense. So I have a first set of questions for all three panelists that are related to the way in which they configure the temporality of their papers. The first is very, very simple for Mariam, and it's simply about that tentatively slash awkwardly. I would love to know more about where that tentativeness comes from, what seems incomplete or unsatisfying to you about the language of post-racial capitalism, and just maybe to invite people to reflect on that language more broadly. The second question is for Emily. I'm sorry, these are not quite in the order that the papers went in. And it's about the absence of Jews as a racialized category in the paper, and it would seem within post-war racial common sense. The audience won't have seen, there was a footnote in the written version in which Emily kind of explicitly explains that Jews were remarkably absent from CAME discussions, or dismissals of these insane Nazi racial views. They come up very, very rarely. To my mind, this is a screamingly present absence. This is a very loud silence, especially if it's paralleled by an absence in the textbook as well. And so I wondered if more could be made of it in terms of elaborating the kinds of historical disavowals and erasures that are facilitating this project of imagining Europe as a space that does not have race. And beyond that, and this is kind of much more provocative and tentative, and again in line with Sandrine's framing of the presence of the past as being about more than memory, to what degree is the idea of a raceless Europe made possible not just by the forgetting of the final solution, but by the fact of the final solution, right? That is precisely the success of the Hitlerian project of mass murder that underwrites this ability now. So many of Europe's Jews are gone that Europe can be white now. So I wonder if you could say more about that, and then as an extension perhaps more about the relationship between anti-black racism and anti-Semitism as an element of this rewriting of racial space, I'm sorry, in a post-war temporality. Maybe like over a drink later instead of... And finally, Julia, I found fascinating this temporality of yours, of this aftermath of both world wars in this space of repetition with a difference of a second French presence. And I wondered if there might be more to say about the ways in which past and present racial formations butt up against one another in this post-45 moment. I'm sure this is something that your larger project touches on. You say in the written paper... And I found this fascinating, that the continued existence of these living descendants of interwar, interracial couples is missing context in much of the historiography that we see on the next generation, right, of, for example, the children of black American GIs and German women. But then the next generation of post-World War II mixed-race children who have been born now post-45 is not there in your paper. And so I wondered... whether they were present for any of your actors, like in the ways that they thought about and discussed this earlier generation, were they doing that in a context of consciously reflecting on the fact that once again interracial children were being born in a French zone of occupation of Germany. The other thing that I found quite exciting about reading the three of these papers together was the unexpected kind of spaces in Europe and Africa that they moved across in locating a post-1945 intellectual history of race. In totally different ways, Miriam's paper, really totally different ways, Miriam's paper and Emily's both point to the imbrication of the European project, the newly imagined space of a unified, integrated European economy and civilization, with the ongoing project of French colonialism on the African continent. Julia, meanwhile, takes us to this kind of richly complex zone, the French zone of post-war Germany, and shows us the very unexpected ways in which legacies of French imperialism on the African continent echoes there. So here, I'll say less. I just want to pose a couple of questions that these off-kilter geographies posed for me. Miriam, you distinguish between European planners' goals of modernization in the metropole versus development in Algeria. And I had remaining questions, which I'm sure your dissertation, I could go read your dissertation, but instead I'm going to ask you here. I had questions about your view of the metropolitan dimensions of the Constantine plan itself. For example, like the employment targets for Algerian immigrants and so on. I wondered if you could say a bit more about how you conceive of the Algerian and metropolitan elements of the plan fitting or not fitting together, right? Is this two separate projects fundamentally? Or is it a single project that is kind of Mediterranean in scope? Emily, my question for you is about what you call this kind of European-African nexus. And I wondered, you talked towards the end of your paper about a kind of binary that's being created. I wondered whether you could say more about whether Africa in particular really is the place where race goes for your European actors specifically. Is this simply the juxtaposition that you find most productive, right? Or are the European actors in your story talking about Africa in a fundamentally different way than they're talking about? You know, Asia comes up as well, right? So, is French colonialism in Southeast Asia a part of this conversation? You know, in any way, or is this actually about Europe and Africa in particular? Julia. I wondered, I have many questions about the French actors in your story and their racial logics, and I wondered whether you saw from them any overt or implicit reflection on any difference of racial logic in France versus Germany. Do we see the coming together of a kind of European post-war racial imaginary in which, through these denazification trials, the French and Germans are working together within a common racial logic, or are there tensions here? Is France's ongoing colonial presence in North Africa an element of how this past violence is adjudicated for the French actors that are adjudicating it? I think I should stop there in terms of time. That leaves us with about 15 minutes, so I want to thank you all for great papers.
So I'm going to suggest you come up, maybe, just to have a little bit more of a discussion among you and give the... thank you, Emma. You really did do a fabulous job. So do you want to take some of these questions? You want to save them for later and open it up to the audience?
Let's open it up.
Why don't we take several questions at once? I'll write them down, and then we'll try to...
What do you want to...
Questions? Go ahead. Yes, please.
Okay, I'm going to try in English. It's a very simple question, actually. I was wondering how gender could fit in the three histories that you gave, because I got the impression that the actors you were talking about were mostly men. And except for your talk where women were the victims. So I was wondering how gender could fit in this history, especially if you were thinking of in terms of intersectionality and how, all these politics were gendered. That's all. That's my question.
Another question?
Yeah. Collect. Huh?
like you, Rabbit.
Thank you.
Passing it, such as I am.
This is kind of a follow-up to the same question, and it's not so much about gender, but about bodies. And let me just, there was a first of all, I have a colleague whose work I really like, who's writing a book about African-American performers, singers, who come to Europe and perform in the German-speaking world. And it's a book that goes from the late 19th century, classical music performers. And there's a, her name is Keira Thurman. Have you encountered her work? Oh, so you know. So she has this really interesting argument about the way that listening to African-Americans in the 1920s and 30s is received by a German public that is by a German public that is astonished to see black bodies producing the sounds that they associate with this beautiful classical tradition that's so close to their sense of German culture. And she has an argument similar to yours, Emily, where race somehow gets located in the bodies of these singers, whereas the European singers who perform are not racialized, right? And I'm fascinated by that question, and I wanted to connect it to Miriam's paper too, because in yours, the exclusion begins with religion, which helps to produce the ways in which poverty and violence and vulnerability to violence is sort of distributed under the colonial situation, and then the plans for development reinforce this exclusion, but then bodies come in the imagery later, like the that weird and awful image you said about the monstrous bodies, right? Or the overeducated, or was that who's? Oh, that was your paper. I'm getting them mixed up. But you see what I mean? The way that anyway, I'll stop there.
That's the question.
Anybody else like to pose a question? We'll take one more, and then maybe starting.
This should be a short one for Miriam. I was wondering how deep you think the neoliberal economic language goes, whether it's just with the technocrats high up in the French state. And I was wondering that because when you were talking about some of the language, I got echoes of people like François Perrou, who, that's obvious. But then also, elements of it sound a lot like some of Bourdieu's early essays. Some of Bourdieu's early essays, where he's thinking about, we need to change economic relations. We need to think, I think he says, a non-Euclidean form of economics for these people in these places. And also people like Jacques Berck. And so I locate someone like Bourdieu or Berck on like the complete opposite end of the spectrum of like the high bureaucrats and functionaries. So I'm wondering if it's not just them, but that it's just the way that economic thought is being produced at the time, and that it's just part of broader assumptions.
Do you want to go ahead and start answering, and then we'll see where it's going?
Sure, yeah, thank you. Thank you all for your questions, and Emma, your comments were fantastic. Mm-hmm. I will take up the challenge of my awkward and tentative vocabulary, which is the book is now organized around, and I think this might also speak to your point, around racial capitalism, not in the sense that capitalism as implanted in Algeria then impacted the Muslims worse than the settlers. We know that. That's not interesting to me. But what I am interested in, how ideas of Islam are actually part and parcel of the way the economy unfolds. So I could give examples of that, but a lot of the work around citizenship, things like the Senatus Consultus of 1865, it's not just about who gets to be French, it's also about the way the economy gets structured in those decisions. So that's kind of my investment in the racial capitalism. And I guess more and more I'm trying to think about the economy as a site that produces racial distinctions, even though they're already built in some ways. So that brings me to the post. and this is why I'm tentative about kind of making it more jargon than it needs to be. But within the racial capitalist moment that's built on understandings of Islam already, there's a way in which there's a disavowal of race that comes about through culturalist notions. So that when my planners can look at what's not working, rather than saying, oh, it's because of these settler colonial structures, they can use ideas about aptitudes as kind of the argument of what's really to be planned, right? They're not interested in rethinking capitalism and race. They're interested in intervening on Muslim bodies and psychological structures, because that's the reason capitalism is not working. I write a lot about Bourdieu and Peru in this manuscript, specifically around Bourdieu's works on the peasant. And I think this gets back to Emma's point about how is this different from the metropole, is that my planners are very worried that the fellah in Algeria are not the peasant in France. And actually, I've had conversations with Venus about this because we both are thinking about agriculture.
Exactly.
And so it's been really helpful sharing my work with her, and she commented really generously on a dissertation chapter saying, you know, this vocabulary of moralizing, of not giving credit because, sorry, of not giving certain kinds of charity to farmers would never happen in France. That's right. That so the way that agricultural credit structures are set up in Algeria are precisely to avoid seeing as being too charitable, because what they really want are these actors to become economic actors. And they're much more generous with the settlers. There's different credit structures for both communities. So I'm going to let some other people take the questions. Those are my preliminary answers. And I'd love to talk about, I'm like obsessed with François Perry right now. So I don't know what you just stumbled into.
Yes, thank you, Emma, for great questions. And we have a chance maybe later to talk a little bit more about some of them. But the most striking and in some ways puzzling aspect of my project is, which starts in the 20s and then goes up to the 50s, that in the post-World War II era, there's actually very, very broad discussion of how to integrate the biracial children of black GIs, and as a way of showing Germany is no longer a Nazi state, and we can integrate racially, and maybe even better than the Americans are doing it, right? So there's a lot of this very charged with these redemptive aspirations as well. And the first generation of the 20s comes up sometimes in these discussions, but often it's assumed they're no longer around. They're like an extinct species, even though as adults they're present in German society, and they're actually struggling for reparations. But that's the parallelism, the disconnectedness is really striking. And when they come up in these debates, it's always in terms of, we have to avoid that this can ever happen again, that a whole generation of biracial German children can perish. You know, so we really need to do a better job with the second generation. But it's, and I have to look if the second, the first generation themselves were aware of these debates, and if this is part of maybe what energizes them, that there is this debate about racial integration of the black children of German children of black GIs. The interesting thing with, you know, bodies is that from the 1920s onwards, this is a very kind of blurry sense of black bodies. In the 1920s, there's a propaganda campaign against colonial French soldiers in the Rhineland. It's called the Black Shame on the Rhine. Now, only a small minority of colonial soldiers are actually from sub-Saharan Africa. There's some Senegalese, but they actually get removed very quickly in 1920. So most of the troops are North African, Moroccan, Tunisian, and then there are also some sizable, you know, smaller groups of Vietnamese French soldiers. But they're all turned into black soldiers. And so for the Americans and the French, that's rather puzzling, because that's not how in the Americans and French, you know, conceive of blackness or black people.
So it is a different racial logic.
That's it is a different racial logic, and I'm still trying to figure out what changes after World War II. I think if we look at the alignment with American notions of blackness, what we're missing is we're having, again, North African French soldiers in Germany who are actually, and that's crucial, Muslim. The black GIs are Christian. And by not talking about the French soldiers and not making that part of the discussion and their children, there's the complexity of Germany's own racial makeup and racial past also gets flattened, right? Because there are biracial Germans who are also Muslim, right? And if we talk about racial integration, one would have to include them as well. But the debate about racial integration doesn't include them, right? So there's an interesting moment here where Germans move away from overt expressions of anti-Semitism. They seem to embrace, to some extent, U.S. notions of a kind of black-white binary, though I would argue that is actually also a German tradition that gets reactivated. But behind the scenes, so to speak, there's also now the Muslim other who now gets kind of hidden in this. And that's gender, just briefly, is very important also in individual biographies because, of course, it's terrible for men and women to be unable to make the choice to have children. But for many of the women, it's doubly difficult because, in the 1950s, the expectation is, and maybe it still is, women should be mothers. And some of the women are rejected when their husbands find out that they cannot have children. So the suffering, the consequences are gender-specific, and among other things, that's where gender is very important, for example.
I'll take the Jews question first. So I very much think that the presumption is like basically Jews are gone, so it's not an issue anymore. So within the conference that I was talking about, they're doing a lot of different things of cultural reconstruction and planning related beyond just formal education. One of the things that they're talking about is books, sort of the circulation of books in post-war Europe, when Europe is liberated. And there's a discussion about what they should do with all the Jewish books in Europe and whether or not they should send them all to Jerusalem because they don't necessarily belong in Europe anymore. And then somebody's like, maybe it's not a good idea to put all the Jewish books in the same place. it's like this really bizarro conversation about imagining this Europe that is, free of Jews, right? So they don't actually have control over all of the Jews. So this is like an imaginary conversation. But nonetheless, it's interesting about where that goes, right? I mean, and that's in 45. War is clearly going to be won. But anyway. In my own work, I realize I kind of follow the logic in which Jews are deracialized. So when I write about religion in the book, that's where I actually talk about Jews because now Jews have been recoded as exclusively a religious group. And then, of course, in the French metropolitan context, they're also like doubly recoded as French. And that's in the context of an emerging, culturalization of religion in general and then also the racialization of Islam. So that's like the way in which I talk about it. But it's true that I hadn't thought about it, but I totally reproduce that that move in like the sort of chapter organization of the book. So that's good to think about. There are a lot of other things to touch on, but the question of bodies, I don't, I'm not used to thinking about bodies. I'm a sort of intellectual and institutional and political historian, so it's a tough question, even though it is something I should engage with more explicitly because the kind of material that I cite here is sort of everywhere in the sort of policy world. And I mean, Emma, you described what I was talking about, the sort of racial formation as ideological, but for me, it's institutional, too. I mean, yes. This is the moment where, all of these institutions are being created, and that's the feedback loop, right? Yes. So the things that people think, they're creating institutions to, in response to the way they think people are, and then those institutions produce some of those effects, right? These are bodies moving through all of these spaces, and it's true that in most of my work they're male bodies. But I still haven't figured out how to, tackle the gender question, because most of my book is about students, and so the vast majority of African students in this period are male, but not exclusively. And the policy world is a male world. How I want to talk about that, how I want to talk about the way in which this entire project is gendered. Because, we know that, a sort of particular vision of, education as politics is about the production of a particular gendered male citizen and subject. So, it's not that that's not there. It's just I haven't worked it out yet. But a good point. Thank you, Venus.
I think we have time for a couple more questions. And where's the mic? Oh, you have.
We started late, right?
And
late. Christy Pekikra, George Mason University. Thank you for this wonderful panel. It is just fantastic through the commentary, and so I'm really glad that you all had the chance to pick up some of those questions. I wanted to say, I am one of the descendants of this generation, the second generation of racially mixed people, and so I found this to be sort of triggering in some way, and I found myself very embodied, and it's oddly existentially sort of odd and threatening to sort of think of the fact that I wouldn't be here if my mother had been sterilized, and so that's sort of so there's ways in which this comes very close, I think, to individuals that one can encounter in talking about this work. So the embodiedness of this feels very real to me as a descendant of this group of people. And there are so many wonderful questions on the floor right now, but one thing that I wanted to pick up that's maybe for all of the panelists has to do, this went to this moment, Emily, when you talked about Senghor thinking that he had an ally in this official and that it turned out to be completely not the case. And I'm wondering, in these projects of racial justice and of reparations, what are the dynamics of being an ally when the rubber hits the road, when these policies are being rolled out, when individuals are being spoken to, when plans are being made on the ground and things are being built or not built? These are collaborative ventures in that space, and so it seemed like this was a case of a real deep disappointment of a promise unfulfilled between individuals. And so I'm just wondering if that's something that you could pick up on and tell us about. It's also a timely subject for this moment where we're thinking so much about allies and about combating structural racism. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. I just, mine is not so much a question, but a very brief comment. I want to thank you all for these really exciting and generative papers and trying to rethink, to borrow your expression, conceptual repertoires of race. I was thinking I want to pick up on something Emma said, because what's striking to me, so Emily, you said you were a political historian. I would like us to think as to what Emma suggested, which is, what does that mean for all of you to think that you are participating in an intellectual history of race, and how you're pressing against a deep-seated tradition of European intellectual history that has refused to consider the question of race, unlike American and African-American intellectual history, where the question is posed around race, around freedom, around all of those. And I was wondering, well, I mean, to me, that's the challenge you're bringing. You are pressing against sort of that tradition that is trying to tackle these large political histories after 1945 without doing the work that you're all doing in sort of racial capitalism, the question of institutions and political imaginaries of race, or sort of the social body of the nation and its reproductive impulses. So I would just like to thank you for that, because I think it's urgent and necessary work right now. So thank you.
Do we actually have to cut at this point for the recording? I'm so sorry, but that's. But we can keep talking without our devices. I just, and let's give a big hand.